The recording has started. I first of all want to thank the Fuchsman's Learning in the Shul. This week is graciously sponsored by June and Alex Fuchsman and family, commemorating the Yahrzeit of June's father, the unforgettable Getzel ben Yechezkel Mendel, who was such a towering influence here when he used to come to visit. He was just such a fun, friendly, energetic person, and yet he always had a good word for everybody. And so I hope that our words of Torah and a little bit of Jewish history, I think, will serve as a schus for Aliyas Neshama. And I want to welcome you back to the building. This is the first time in a long time we've gotten together on Thursday night. And Bezras Hashem, in subsequent weeks, I'll do my best to make sure that we will be duly rewarded gastrointestinally. So if you have requests for what type of gastrointestinal, and as long as it doesn't involve Pisces, I'll be very happy, and I'll do my best to assist. Can you hear me online? If you can hear me, just nod your head yes. Can't.
Yes, we can hear you.
Excellent. Thank you, Doc. Okay. No, I like people to be able to talk up. Tonight I want to start a four-part series. The four-part series is my personal response to some of the thoughts that have been going on in my mind. Right, and of course, I believe very strongly that when we go through issues in life, when we deal with issues that go on in certain areas of the world, in kol chadash tachas hashamash, nothing new happens in the world, and so it's always important and essential for us to sort of like put things into a context. Let nothing we say or discuss in the next 4 weeks be assumed to be a proof to one side or the other. I think what we're going to actually discover is, when tragedy goes on, ain't sorrows boast li Yisrael, no sorrows happen for the Jewish people. Ela b'shvil she Yisrael. When God sends a message somewhere in the world, there has to be some message for us. And when I thought about the area of the Ukraine, where all the great tragedy is happening right now, and of course our thoughts and our prayers are with everybody, and especially the Jewish people who are certainly dealing with the conditions that are out there, part of my mind goes back to certain eras of Jewish history and see how the Jewish people back then responded to tragedy. And there have been a number of different tragic events that have happened in that same area. But more important than just the terrible tragedy, and we'll start with the background of one in particular, there also was a lot of different responses throughout history from the Ukraine region that continue to reverberate today and have impact today. And each one of the steps in the series tonight, and then going into next week, and then we'll have a break for Purim because you always have to have a Purim, and then the 2 weeks subsequent, we're actually going to look at different elements of Jewish history, modern Jewish history, some of the great debates that are going on in Jewish history today, all of which find themselves in some elements drawn back to the Ukraine. What I will warn you in advance is we are also going to find that nothing travels through the world unless it travels through one city in the United States. And what city is that? Beautiful, the Greater Elizabeth. So there will be Elizabeth connections that will spark their way in, because after all, let's take a look where we're sitting. So I want to go back into relatively modern Jewish history. When you think of the area of the Ukraine, there is one element and one major episode in Jewish history and European history. And actually, there's a diversity in the way that we examine that history, depending on which side you're looking at, that had a major impact on the way that Jews and religious responses to tragedy happened. And I refer, of course, to the episodes that began in 1648-1649, known as the Chelmanitsky Massacres. Who is Chelmanitsky? Not what is a Chelmanitsky, who is Chelmanitsky? Bogdan Chelmanitsky was a registered Cossack. He lived a challenging life from the secular historical side. He was stuck straddling nobility and common man status. He sort of fit in somewhere in the middle. In 1620, he was a relatively young guy, and there was a war going on with the Ottoman Turks, and his father was killed in the battle, and he was later ransomed by the Turkish. In 1638, he was sold into slavery with the Ottoman Turks, and later somehow somebody came through and ransomed him, and he wound up coming back to the Ukraine. In 1638, 18 years later, he who had already identified himself with a certain group known as the Cossacks. Can you see and hear me, Doc? Are you able to hear me? Okay. So in 1638, he was subjected together with the other Cossacks, whether they were registered Cossacks like Khmelnytsky or rebel Cossacks, they were lumped into one major group in the Ukraine and forced to be become subjects of the Roman, of the Polish government, and specifically the Polish Senate, known as the Sejm. It's interesting, the Sejm would later serve as a base for certain Jews as well. Meir Shapiro, the founder of the Daf Yomi movement, was also a senator in the Sejm, in the Polish Sejm. But that I don't want to confuse the periods in history. I'm just going to mention. So the Polish became the leading group, and the Ukrainian Bogdan Khmelnytsky, the Cossack, certainly found himself under the hand, under the thumb of the Polish. Now, when Alexander took over in 1646, he redrew the maps of all of his possessions, and he decides, hey, guess what? You see the things I own? So one of the things I own is going to be Khmelnytsky's estate. And so, therefore, Alexander, who is the magnate in that area of the Ukraine, decides, hey, I'm going to keep this piece of land, which belongs to Khmelnytsky. And trying to find protection from this grab from the magnate, Khmelnytsky writes a bunch of different leaders in Poland, and he even appeals straight to the king of Poland, but he gets no response. And at the end of 1645, Saplinski, Czaplinski, who gets authority from the local magnate, this Kanas Polski, and he is told to seize Khmelnytsky's estate. Khmelnytsky's estate is known as Subotov. By the way, that's where ultimately he is buried. And he tried to meet with the king to get his land back. And he met the king twice, but the king didn't want to upset the local magnate because however strong the king was, he couldn't mess with the underlings. And so Khmelnytsky gets forced off his land in 1647. 1647, he's kicked off his land. His wife drops dead, and he's got all these little kids. He's got to figure out, what am I going to do with them? I'm really just a Cossack. So he has to marry somebody else, and he takes a second wife. This episode is known in Ukrainian history as the Saplinski Affair, and it is known in the Ukraine as the immediate cause for an uprising. It was a catalyst for actions that showed popular discontent. And so although this was like the immediate thing that caused this uprising, there were certain issues that were the undercurrent. The Polish were Roman Catholics. The Ukrainians were primarily Greek Orthodox. Greek Orthodox. So ethnicity became an issue. And the economics also favored into the issues as well. And so a lot of the oppression that the Ukrainian people felt, including Khmelnytsky, they certainly felt from the Polish magnates. And on the one hand, and of course, the Polish land magnates were no fools. They had to make sure that somebody took care of the accounting and made sure that the taxes were paid and made sure that everything was kept in the real estate in line. And so, who do you hire to go take care of those jobs? Well, if he's not a doctor and he's not a lawyer, he's an accountant, right? And so they hired a lot of Jews, or he works in real estate, right? So they hired a lot of Jews. Now, these Jews wind up sandwiched between the big Polish overlords, the magnates, and the people who hate them. And so as a result, when the people like Khmelnytsky sort of decide they're going to take something out on people, they're going to take it out on the Polish, but they're also not going to forget the Jews, because after all, the Jews are associated with oppression and taking your land and all sorts of other stuff. And so the Cossacks begin an uprising, and they have a lot of success. In fact, if you go back even into modern times, right? I'm talking as late as 2018. When this uprising started, this is deemed to be the liberty and the democracy, the democratic history of the Ukraine. And who's standing right there in the middle of all of it? Bogdan Khmelnytsky. If you take a look inside many different cities in the Ukraine, you can't see it at home, but you know, there are statues dedicated to Khmelnytsky on the Ukrainian money in some of the bills. Bogdan Khmelnytsky,
the five.
Yeah, the grivna. I couldn't pronounce it, but yes. So you know, 73% as of 2018, 73% of Ukrainians look at Bogdan Khmelnytsky and they think to themselves, "Wow, he's pretty chashuv. Like he's a positive guy in our history, right?" Of course, if you go to the Polish and you ask them, Bogdan Khmelnytsky, good or bad? It's almost the exact reverse. 73% say terrible, horrible, ruthless. Right? Jewish history, of course, we see him a lot worse than that because he blames the Jews for helping the Polish nobility. And so he decides he's going to get rid of all Jews from the Ukraine. And so based on the Treaty of Zborov, the Jewish people were forbidden to live on the territory that were controlled by Cossack rebels. And the uprising somehow leads to the death of approximately, well, the numbers disagree as to how much the numbers there are. It's the numbers in Ukraine are as low as 18,000 to 20,000 Jews. However, in some of the works we're going to quote in a couple of moments, we're going to see the numbers get as high as 100,000. Reb Shabsi HaKohen, otherwise known by his acronym, the Shach, who is one of the major, major commentaries on the side of Shulchan Aruch. You talk about the Shach, you're talking about, you know, major stuff. He lived in Ukraine, and he was there during the period of the Gzeros Tachentat, the decrees, the Khmelnytsky uprisings between 1648 and 1649. And he writes in Megillas Eifa, which is the recollection of his period in time, of his recollections of what happened during this period in time, he says the numbers are as high as 100,000 Jews. Maybe to us, when we start talking about 6 million, 100,000 may not be a major number. But back then, in Europe, 100,000 Jews to be killed is a terrible situation. And there's a famous work that appeared even more popular and more descriptive than the Megillas Eifa, is the Sefer Yavin Metzula, which was written by the Rabbi of Nemirov, which we'll talk about in a second. And he describes in painstaking detail that how these 100,000 or whatever number it was, Jews were killed. And let's just say the atrocities were horrible. There are people who are, you name the ruthless way of killing somebody, and I can guarantee you that somewhere in the Yavin Metzula or in the Megillas Eifa, we have descriptions of the Cossacks doing that to the Jews. There were people who were burned alive. There were people who were cut to pieces, limb by limb. There were people who were forced to kill one another. Where there were people, women who were pregnant, who had their insides, the fetuses ripped from behind them, and somehow cats were put in their place to scratch them out from the inside. Very descriptive, horrible deaths. And all because this ruthless group was there. So between 1648 and 1649, that was the rise of the Cossack Rebellion. But when we talk about this period in time, we often extend it to 1656, part of which is because certain wars that broke out, the Russo-Polish War between 1654 and 1677, and the Russo-Swedish War 1656 to 1658, they all seem to sort of pile one on top of the other, negatively impacting the Jewish community. And so therefore, you know, we really, really get a certain perspective. In the Yavin Metzula, and this work that in great detail describes just exactly what happened during those couple of years, we see that he describes, the author, Ramosha Hanover, who wrote the book, who was a capitalist, a recognized capitalist, the Rav of Nemirov, talks about how the whole thing started out as unfortunately, most things do, right? When things don't work out for the Jews, it's usually because it's Jew versus Jew. And so he describes a certain Yaakov Sabolinsky, who happened to actually have been very close with Khmelnytsky. And he advised him that after a certain Jewish tax collector had warned that Khmelnytsky was planning to kill the Polish magnate, the Polish lord, that Khmelnytsky was, Khmelnytsky was of course investigated and found and thrown into prison. And this Yaakov Sabolinsky says, I have an idea on how you can get out. And so he came up with a plan. Now the plan failed and Khmelnytsky got out, but then he got thrown back into prison. and he was transferred from one side of the Ukraine to the other side into an area known as Brody or Broad. All these names are actually quite in the news these days, right? Notwithstanding, while he's in this prison in Broad, the Cossacks come to visit him from the outside, and he looks at them and he says, "I don't understand. Why are you guys just sitting there? You guys should be outraged. Make a riot. You know, Cossack lives matter. It's important to go ahead and make a big deal out of this. And let me get out of here. And you guys should riot and make a sign and make something out of it." And so the Cossacks get crazy. And they certainly have to, they have no choice, the Polish, but to spring Chmielnicki. And Chmielnicki continues to rile up the crowd, not only against the Polish, but also against the Jews. As Rabbi Hanover writes, he says, it's one thing if the Polish, the great Polish leaders, are supposed to be ruling over us, but God forsake the Jewish people. They're the lowest of the low. They're going to rule over us as well? Couldn't understand that. And so around Purim time 1648, we're talking about this time in the year, right? The king and the lords hear that there's something rising over here, and they should do something about it. And they said they don't have to worry, because Chmielnicki already has been caught twice, and they've sent him back to prison both times, so we don't have to worry about him. But this time, Chmielnicki had made a pact with the Tartars, right? And so he went ahead, and he has the backup of the Tartars. And so between the Cossacks and the Tartars, they take on the Polish, and he decimated the Polish army, and also winds up decimating the Jewish community at the same time. He takes children, and he uses them as bridges till their lives are stomped out. Right, he raped the women, he murdered the women. Whole communities are described by Rabbi Yaakov Hanover, Moshe Hanover, as being destroyed. And he goes community by community, and names like Nemirov, Tolstein, Polonoi, Ostra, Lvov, Dubna, Brody, each one is described, and he watches how each one of them get destroyed.
What do you know? What area of Ukraine this is?
So it's actually, it starts on one end of the Ukraine where the Russians are attacking, but it goes all the way out to the west, because you have to remember this area that is modern Ukraine consisted of two major areas of Jewish communal life. You have the Ukraine area, and you also have an area known as Galicia, right, which is also part of Ukraine today. And when you talk about Galicianers, you're also talking about part of communities that were there as well. And many of the Jewish casualties were also at the hands of the Tartars. Now, among them were about 1,000 who were taken by the Tartars and get sold in the slave markets in the Ottoman Empire. Another group gets forced to convert to Eastern Orthodoxy, and a lot of others start fleeing to other parts of Poland, to Lithuania, to Italy, to Holland, and they lose all their money and they endure great hardship. And the Shach and others described this in great detail in some of the keynotes that they wrote for a special day that they commemorated the attacks. You remember the date? The 20th of Sivan, which was selected as a day to fast and to mourn the Gezeros of 1648-1649. Dr. J.J. Schachter has an article and tradition that came out a number of years ago when he argued in favor of commemorating Yom HaShoah. In it, he argues that this is not a new idea to have special commemoration days on the Jewish calendar, because there were previous days that were recorded to remember specific tragedies. And one of them was the 20th of Sivan. The Jewish community in Nemirov, Ukraine, which was populated by many thousands of Jews, was destroyed on that day. And Rabbi Chil Michel had passionately implored the people to keep their faith and that they should die. Al Kiddush Hashem. And when the Shach tells the story of the community, he says for 3 days the Cossacks rampaged through the town, murdering thousands of Jews, including the aforementioned Rabbi Yechiel Michel. The shul was destroyed. All the Sifrei Torah were torn to pieces and trampled. Their parchment got used for shoes and clothing. Sound familiar? Sound familiar from other Jewish atrocities? Maybe a little bit more modern? Merely 5 years before, the community of Nemirov had as its leader the great Rabbi Yom Tov Lipman Halevi Heller, otherwise known as the Tosfos Yontif. Very important to our family because on my mother's side of the family, we are descendants of the Tosfos Yontif. And he had been the Rav of Nikolsburg, of Vienna, of Prague. When 1648-1649 came about, the Tosfos Yontif had already moved to Krakow, Poland. And but the Shari Tshuva in Or HaChaim quotes the Shach as saying that this was a gezeira, this was a takana that was instituted by the group that was most responsible dealing with all the different European matters. It was known as the Vad Arba Aratzos, and they established this day of commemoration on the 20th of Sivan. He says one of the reasons why is there's a unique calendaric reason why. And what is that? The day never falls out on Shabbos. You can never have a day, you can never have a question about the 20th of Sivan, because this way it gets to be observed every single day. This is every single year. So this is one of the background descriptions of the Gezeros Tachentat. So you can understand why in the Ukraine today, there are a lot of people who feel certain ways about the history of Ukraine, right? And the history of Ukraine to the Jewish community, right? And the truth is, Jews responded very differently to different tragedies that were expanded upon. But really sort of began 1648, 1649. So what I hope to do, and we'll start right now, is start examining some of the responses. There'll be about four major ones that I want to take up. Some of them we'll look at positively. Other ones we will not have such positive views of. But the first one, I think, is a very positive view. Some of the things that came about post-1648, 1649 was a desire to rebuild. And within that area of rebuilding was a desire to rebuild on the basis of increased scholarship. As the Shach himself writes, during this period in time, had he not been involved in writing, it would have gone insane. And so he sat down to write his commentary on Shulchan Aruch during this period in time. And there was a tremendous amount of increase in knowledge that came about because there were needs to be met at this period in time. And one of the major ones, which happens to correspond to the time of year we're holding in right now, we're about to start a Masechta in the Dafyomi cycle known as Yevamos. And my dear friend Keshet Star also had contacted me earlier this week asking if we could bring in some of the stuff she's working on in her organization. I realized that it all sort of surrounds the same idea, which we will start spending some time on, and that is the issue of the Aguna, right? What is an Aguna? So generally speaking, when we talk about Agunos today, we talk about what's called the man-made Aguna. It's, by the way, the least common Aguna in the Jewish works. That's almost an American concept. It's not totally, but you know, it's the modern time where we have what we call, I wrote in my notes, the big jerk, right? Where he refuses to give his wife a get, right? Even though the marriage is, for all intents and purposes, dead, and so she becomes sort of dependent and waiting. And that's where great organizations do great work. Batei Din work very hard, and the organization Ora works very hard, right? It's the organization for the resolution of Agunot to try to deal with that situation. But it's the least common in the rabbinic literature. We have two other types of Agunos. One is a what we call a get aguna, where there is a contested get, and the husband just disappeared before the status could be clarified. So that woman remains stuck. And then the third one, which is the one that where the scholarship really exploded around this period in time, was what we call the classic aguna. The classic aguna was a man who disappeared, with his wife not knowing whether he was alive or dead. And it's that one that became quite prominent now when people were being torn away, they were being sold to who knows where, they were killed on the run, and we didn't have proof one way or another. So even if you managed to get away from the atrocity on site in your hometown, you could still have wound up stuck with this tremendous challenge. So the Gemara in Baba Basra on Daf Ayin Gimel Amud Aleph identifies the concept of Aguna coming from the word Ogen. What's an Ogen? So an Ogen is an anchor, right? And the Mishnah says that when you sell a ship, you're selling the anchor with the ship. It's understood. What is an anchor? An anchor keeps you stuck where you are right now. Rus, in the Megillas Rus, Naomi tells the two girls, Rus and Arpah, Halahain Teagena, you're going to wait until I have a baby? You can't remarry, and the children certainly can inherit until they know that their father or husband has passed away, right? So the children are stuck and the mother is stuck. And what do we do about the situation? So at this period in time, we start to hear some crazy, wacky stories that happen. And it takes a certain rabbinic backbone to be able to handle these types of questions. Because if you make a mistake as to whether the chicken was kosher or wasn't kosher, what happens in the process? Worst comes to worst, you did an Avera. And you know what you could do for that? Tshuva. But the other week we were talking about Me'uvas lo yuchal liskon. Shlomo HaMelech talks about certain tragedies where you do something, that's a bad thing, and you can't fix it. Well, what's a classic example of a Me'uvas lo yuchal liskon? So the Gemara says, a mamzer. If somebody goes ahead and has relations with a married woman, and the woman gets pregnant and she has a baby, you can't fix that. That kid's life is over. And the marriage is over. And she's not only forbidden to be married to you, she's forbidden to be married to anybody else. You're stuck. She's stuck. So you got to be very careful before you answer these questions. On the other hand, you have hundreds of women who are floating around Eastern Europe at this point in time, and they can't go on with their lives because they need solutions. So Rav Yaakov Emden, and we're going to hear a lot about Rav Yaakov Emden this week, and then we're going to hear more about him next week, and next week he's going to play a very major role. But this week, Rav Yaakov Emden, in the introduction to his work, Megillah Sefer, tells a story about his own background and his own history. He tells a story about his great-grandfather, right, who was the author of the Sefer Shaar Ephraim. And he said that he had a daughter named Nechama, who was a very, very nice girl, and she had gotten married to a guy named Yaakov, who was a big, big Talmud Chacham, and he said they were very much in love and very well recognized. And here it was, 1648, when they were in the Ukraine, and Chalmanitsky came in, and he came into the communities, and he entered the city where they were, and he goes ahead and goes after this Yaakov, who married his great-grandfather's daughter, Nechama. We'll see, was his grandmother, right? And he's brought down, and he's told to lower his head, to bend his head down, and the executioner is standing there holding the axe, and as he gets ready to go ahead and chop his head off, right, the axe falls, and it just misses him. And he rolls over and he hides among the dead. And people are swearing up and down the line. They saw him, they saw the executioner chop him dead. And they saw him get rolled into the pile of corpses, which all of which was true except for one minor factor. And what was that? Right? The executioner missed. So, and of course, this Rav Yaakov turns around and he hides among the dead bodies for 8 days. Right, so nobody knows what's going on, and people come to testify to Tribish, which is where the Shaar Ephraim is hiding, right? And they come to ask, right? Can she remarry? And there are a number of witnesses who came forward and said, we saw him dead, which is going to be important for us when we get into this in Yevamos. So there are witnesses that are convinced the guy's dead. Right? And they testify and they offer very sincere testimony. And guess what happens? He turns around and he says, I'm sorry, it was Rav Heschel, the Abbezdin of Krakow, right, who said that this Nechama is allowed to remarry. Her husband's dead, and he paskin, she's allowed to marry. Nechama has something in her heart. Right? Like the Pasuk says, Vayima'in lehistachim, that Yaakov Avinu also, he couldn't right? He couldn't accept consolation because, as Rashi says, it's a Nechama also. She refuses. Now, here she is, this young girl, relatively young. Her parents are dying to get her remarried. It's not a good thing to be a young, spry, single girl walking around during the era of the Cossacks, right? But she says she won't accept it and she's going to wait. And sure enough, what happens? A half a year later, 6 months later, guess who walks into Krakow? Rav Yaakov. And people are going crazy. They're going nuts. So Rav Heschel, who was the Abbezdin of Krakow, so freaked out, he said, from now on, I will never answer an Aguna Shaila again, because what if I'm wrong? Look what would have happened. Wow. So he says he's never going to deal with the situation. And that's a very serious danger. as an excuse for her waiting, she winds up having a child with her husband. The child's name is Tzvi. He becomes known as the author of the Chacham Tzvi. Very good. In fact, whenever he signed his name, he would always write Chacham Tzvi Samach Tet. What's Samach Tet? It's the Rashi Tevos Sfardi Tahor, that he came from a proper lineage, right? And you know, he wanted to highlight the fact that he was a good, solid individual. But based on Reb Heschel of Krakow, the assumption was we should be machmir, we should be strict in all aguna cases. So the Chavos Yair, Rav Yair Bacharach, had dealt with this question, and he says no. He says throughout generations, we find that the shaila of an aguna is a dangerous, dangerous thing to be machmir on. Even the great saintly Rush, who lived many, many years prior, says we need to go ahead and find a leniency, right? However, Chazal came up with the idea, especially during this period in time, that we usually don't just take on the issue ourselves. In other words, it's not every single rabbi under the sun who's matir agunos. And by the way, no one Rav who is matir agunos ever winds up doing what? Doing it on his own. In one of the later volumes of Yabia Omer, the ones that came out posthumously, there are a series of tshuvos from Rav Ovadia Yosef, who after the Yom Kippur War, these types of aguna shailas also became prominent again. And Rav Ovadia writes, he comes up with a number of different heterim to help out with the aguna situations. But he always ends off by saying, now take it to two other people before you put it into practice, which is the standard. But we did find that there was this was one of those situations where they had to first solve the idea that we can solve aguna crises. In 1646, Rav Menachem Mendel Krochmal of Nikolsburg, known as the Tzemach Tzedek, but not the Lubavitch Tzemach Tzedek, the real Tzemach Tzedek. And he gives permission to a man to marry the wife of his father-in-law, who, by the way, was not his... He did not give the permission. He heard that the man was given permission to marry the wife of his father-in-law, who is not his wife's mother, because that would be a problem. So it was his father-in-law had a second wife, who was not his wife, and he wanted to marry her, right? So the Tzemach Tzedek tells him, don't do it. Don't. I don't think it's a good plan, but he says that his instructions were ignored. So he says, when the instructions were ignored and he found out that the town was planning the wedding, he says, my hands trembled, but I said nothing. They asked him, why did you say nothing? If you thought that this was a bad plan, why did you say nothing? He says, look, I gave instructions otherwise, but these people asked the Shaila, and they went to the supposedly learned people in their town who told them, you have a heter to get married. And I can't interfere, because what if the mother-in-law is now pregnant? And just because it doesn't look right, should not be a reason for us to call a child a mamzer and force the mother to get out of the marriage. Still, he says, what do we learn from this? Even learned people, not everyone is equipped to deal with an aguna case. So, when we deal with aguna cases, we have to, find the basis from within which we can find a basis for heter. There's not a lot in the Gemara about heterim for agunos. There's not a lot in the Rishonim. A lot of this stuff started to come up, the bases and the rules start coming up as a result of things that are written in the Shilas and Shuvas literature, often after tragedies, including and starting primarily, I'd say, in large number, around this period of time, because of the Gezeros Tach and Tat. So the Chacham Tzvi, the aforementioned Chacham Tzvi, the child of the parents who refused to, the mother and the chamer didn't want to get married. So he writes in his own tshuvas, in Simen Kuf Lamed Dalet, he tells the story, he says, you have to follow the flow of the story. If you're looking at an aguna situation and it sounds too good to be true, use common sense. So he tells a crazy story about a woman who was an aguna for 13 years, who says, oh, she went to the next town and she finally found a witness. Now, generally speaking, we need two witnesses for financial issues, but when it comes to Isurim, when it comes to potential violations, even a serious Isur like this one, we say, Eid Echad, very good. Eid Echad Neman B'Isurim, but there has to be a good witness, right? So he's, and by the way, it would follow, as we'll see in a couple of minutes, where we say Eidach HaNeman B'Yisurin, that includes not only men, but women as well. So the Chacham Tzvi says, look, if somebody finds a witness in the next town and it took 13 years to find that witness, you better do a little bit more investigation, make sure that she didn't pay the guy off something because she's going crazy. There was the rest of that story involves a situation where the witness came along and said, he found her husband dead, tied to a tree, and he was buried right next to it. Like, it seemed a little bit wild. The Tzemach Tzedek tells another story that happened during this period in time about two men who went with a servant from Nikolsburg to Vienna on business. And they made it all the way to Vienna. That they were for sure able to tell, but they didn't make it back to Nikolsburg. And the rumor was that they were killed by a non-Jew. Again, the Cossacks, it was common during that time. So there were two men, not that the servant was single, but the two men were married. And so they pleaded for information. So no one came forward. Then three witnesses happened to show up. One was a non-Jew who knew one of the men, and one of the two men, who, by the way, the Tzemach Tzedek says, both men had been married for less than a year. Right? They were married for less than a year, so these two women are agunos for a less than a year investment into a marriage. You can hear the pain. I'm looking at the look on your face, right? You hear the pain in what's going on in his mind as he's tackling the question. So he says, this non-Jew is there, and he calls out, Anshel, Anshel, to one of the guys, he sees Anshel is dead, and he goes over to another non-Jew to get the rest of the story, who says, yeah, you think you know Anshel, I know Anshel, and he tells him a whole story about how he was beheaded. And he was there, and he saw the whole thing. He might have done the whole thing. That's even a different discussion. Then a second witness came along and said, yeah, I was there also, and I got the same story out of the same non-Jew. Maybe he thought that guy wanted money. And the third guy also heard a story from a non-Jew and also heard the story and heard the name Anshel. So the Tzemach Tzedek says, what do I do about this situation? I don't have any one legitimate witness who's able to come along and say he saw it, but I do have a non-Jew who claims that he knows the story of the beheading. So the Tzemach Tzedek says, here, and he begins by saying, here we see the great tragedy of an aguna. And he says, he implores the reader, and subsequently all the others who get involved in the issues of aguna, he says, we have to remember koach dehetera adif, meaning if you have a basis to go ahead, now is the time for us to try to do what we can. He says, however, that said, there are a couple of problems over here. When the first guy came along and he got the news out of the first non-Jew, we have a concept in halacha called a non-Jew who is what we call mesiach lefi Tumo, which means the non-Jew just happens to be talking. So then we can trust him, because why would he bother to make something up? So if a non-Jew happens to come along and say, oh, this food is kosher because we only use kosher ingredients because everyone knows that it's better. So if I asked him, that's not called Mesiach Lefi Tumo. I asked him. But if he happens to say, oh yeah, you guys are Jewish, we only use kosher also in our baking products, there are times where we are able to rely on that because he's offering his opinion on his own. But here, it wasn't Mesiach Lefi Tumo, says the Tzemach Tzedek. What was the problem? We asked him for the news, and he gave us the news. And that caused a great challenge. He says also, maybe you want to argue because he paid money to get the news. Maybe that ruined things. So the Tzemach Tzedek says, paying for reward for information, that's not going to change anything. Because you don't know what the information is that you want. And then he says, we also, when it comes to a non-Jew, we don't care how we got the information. But whatever, right? If the non-Jew gives you the information, you can go with that. And he solves his first major problem. So what does he do in that situation? He uses some lower level simanim, right? Some lower level proofs, like what the clothing that the guy was wearing and the anshel. And he tries to build using these lower level simanim to sort of allow them to become an acceptable siman, an acceptable proof that the guy who was killed was indeed, the two guys that were killed were these two guys. And this serves as a basis for many other issues that come up down the road in Jewish history, including the granddaddy, the one who's known as the Avi HaGunos, right? Later in history, who is known as, his name was Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan Spector, and he writes a sefer called Ein Yitzchak, and many, many of the tshuvas that he deals with are all about agunos, and he uses a lot of these issues. Like, so for instance, in the tshuvas Ein Yitzchak, he talks about certain instances where we use, he says, a man was found with his passport, right, in the days before the photos, right? So there's no photo ID. So he says, when you have a passport, which people don't usually share, you don't usually give someone else your passport, right? So that, together with certain clear body markings, may be able to serve as a basis for a heter aguna. All this started as a major genre of halachic works as a result of necessity, yes, but also as a result of tragedy. And one last tshuva, just to bring it out, and just to give you just a sampling of some of the things that came out in the realm of scholarship. 1654, remember I told you, yes, the primary Khmelnytsky uprising was 1648 to 1649, but the subsequent wars that came about thereafter, lasted well into the 1650s. So the Cossacks, including Khmelnytsky, aligned themselves with the Russian Muscovites, and they decided they're going to go fight the Polish. And so that precedes the way it is. And so they get to a town called Lublin, which is of course where smack right where we're talking, right? And they attack it on Sukkot in 1656, right? And they start killing people left and right, including the husband of one woman who writes to get a Shaila answered, and her name is Gittel. So Gittel comes, and she comes to the Tzemach Tzedek, not the Lubavitch one, right, the one we've been talking about the whole night, and she comes to him with a document from two witnesses who said that, that her husband was killed, they're sure it was him, and that they buried him. So the Tzemach Tzedek looks at it, and he says, can we verify these signatures? And they say, we can certainly verify one of the signatures. And so the Tzemach Tzedek says, I only need one signature, right? And so what does he do with it? He says, that's it. She can go ahead and remarry, because the fact that I can't bring the witness in the door, it's not a reason for us to hold it up. We have what we need. We have proof. We have verification. Good enough to let her go remarried. But Gittel wasn't so happy with that, because it sounded like he was hemming and hawing. So she says, I can do better. She says, what do you mean you can do better? So she comes into the Beis Din and brings two female witnesses. Now remember, is that a problem? No. On the surface, it's not a problem, unless one of the two females gives you contradictory information. And the Tzemach Tzedek writes that that's exactly what happened over here. One woman offers testimony, yes, this is what happened, and that's the way it goes. But the other one, who happened to be Gittel's sister, says that she was the one who arranged for the document. Right, because she knew she was going to go back to the sister. And she said it took 8 days after the murder for the two men to come along and bury the body. Well, the problem is, we have a halacha that if you're going to identify a person on the basis of what he looks like, just plain, without specific cuts or whatever, you can only do that up until 3 days. After 3 days, we assume the decomposition of the body, or at least of the head, will make the facial features of an individual unrecognizable. And so now it implies that that document that they had is now not worth anything. All right? And so, of course, the Tzemach Tzedek writes in a tshuva why all of a sudden he has a brand new problem. And he goes on for a couple of pages about why he has this problem, but then he stops. And he says, given all the problems that I've just identified, I still think that we can go ahead. Why? Because the fellow did have certain clear markings on his body. He had a certain cut under his ear. And he says that even though I can't prove that that's on the basis of that that's how they identified him, the fact is I have two people who signed along and said that there's a Simon Muvak, she would be able to remarry. And there were a lot of other issues that have come up subsequent in the tshuva literature, again, in order to be able to be matir agunos. Here are just some of the sampling, and that was really my goal tonight, to sort of help you see some of the sampling of what happens to Jews after we face a terrorist situation, a period of terror and tragedy. So one of the things that we wind up doing as a people in order to cope is that we reach out to sort of anchor ourselves. We reach out to try to hold on, to be able to say, what can we do? And it becomes incumbent upon us to be able to trust the rabbinic leadership, to be able to, who are struggling and grappling, and you read these tshuvas and you see how the rabbis are so devastated about the situation, and they're pleading to the people who read their tshuvas that in the future they should be able to use things, and they should be able to try to find ways to be matir the agunos. But at the same time, it provides a certain sense of grounding, and a grounding in a sense of Torah law. And that becomes one of the four approaches that I think that Jews' religious responses to tragedy involve. Just paralleling it, post the Holocaust, we had an explosion of halachic issues that were raised and dealt with. Post wars in Israel, Yom Kippur War in particular, an explosion of Torah study. I have a sefer at home that was written by Rav Volba, Rav Shlomo Volba, called Bein Sheish LaEsor. And he talks about different conversations that he had, talks that he offered between both before the Six-Day War and after the Yom Kippur War. And that was just in one style of learning. Well, the halachic literature is explosive, and you read Rav Ovadia Yosef, who refused to sleep, really, until he was able to solve all the aguna crises of the Yom Kippur War, and some of them are quite crafty. After 9/11, I have tshuvas at home, right, that Rabbi Willig wrote a series of tshuvas that he shared all the way around the world with the great leaders of the time, Zalman Nechemiah Goldberg, Rabbi Ovadia Yosef, Rav Herschel Schachter, others who were working overtime in order to make sure that every single person who was presumed missing, and we have a friend who died in the towers, right? And every single one would be able to go ahead and remarry, and that's the way it was. And certainly we saw it in the tragedies of modern times. We are immediate. One of the things that just served, I can't say it enough, during the period of COVID, right, when we were all lost. We were talking 2 years ago already. It's amazing to think about that. And while everyone was lost, I can say to you from a rabbinic perspective, having the rabbinic scholarship to be able to turn to and to anchor ourselves really helped deal with the tragedy. Especially in those early days, the Purim to Pesach to the end, until like Lag BaOmer, the end of Shavuos time, we were just sitting and trying our best to hold on to the issues. But the back and forth, the rabbinic back and forth, it was tremendously helpful, and it was tremendously useful. So this morning, if you remember, after the Seder, we had a very large contingent of Hasidim who were davened with us this morning. And so a couple of them came over to ask me about the shiur that we're going to have tonight. So one of them happened to mention after davening that he said he found the topic fascinating. And he said, it's so interesting that you chose Aguna. You know, there were a number of Aguna shailos that came up during COVID. So I have to tell you, I had not thought about it, right? Did you realize there were Aguna shailos? But now watch as I present it to you. You're like, of course, of course. So I asked him, how are there Aguna Shailas? He says, think about it for a minute. In the early days of COVID, what happened? We overwhelmed our hospitals around the world, right? And of course, people checked into hospitals, and they didn't necessarily check out, right? And then there were challenges because bodies were piling up, and things were not clear. And there was no one there to identify a death. Why? Why? Because there's no one allowed into the hospitals, right? So you had all these people who were stuck. So this fine gentleman tells me, the Shaila came to the Beis Din, the Karlsberger Rebbe, right? And they're the big poskim, the Karlsberger Rebbe, Zatzal, was one of the big poskim who handles a lot of the Shailas for an organization, a very incredible organization called Misaskim. So he says, take a look. They turn to the Karlsberger Rebbe to figure out. By the time, in some of these cases, the Chevra Kedisha was able to remove bodies from the hospital morgue, or unfortunately, if you recall, some of the trucks, the refrigerated trucks that they were looking for, the identifications didn't necessarily happen. So it raised certain shailas about, can you rely upon a wristband from a hospital, right? Can that be considered a siman muvak? A wristband, you know, when you go into the hospital and they put a wristband on you. I just had a test done in the hospital this week. They said, we're going to put a wristband on you. I said, I'm hoping to leave on my 2 feet today, right? And the guy says, look, you came into the hospital for the test. Anyone who walks in here gets a wristband. And so I thought you only get masks. But no, they get a wristband. So I had the wristband, and this Chassidish fellow, this very lovely guy, was here. He says, we had this conversation 40 feet away from here. And he said to me, those wristbands may have saved a lot of Aguna situations, according to the Carlsberger Rebbe. Aguna Shilas came up, and they started, and sometimes when we respond to tragedy, we sometimes have to look at the tragedy, anchor ourselves in halacha, and use them as the basis to create a solution. That's great when you're a scholar. That's great when you are committed within a certain sense of halacha. It gives you a place to anchor. But what do you do when you don't have the scholarship? What do you do when you have a different type of fervor, right? You want to do something and you want to see there that there's meaning and purpose. So we're going to see that that was handled in three different ways, and that's going to make up the next three sessions. There was one group that grew and moved in a certain direction, and they got very messianic, and they reached into areas. They couldn't make sense out of the trauma, so they couldn't make, they said, let's go into other areas of Torah experience that we also don't understand. And we'll talk about the rise of messianism and Kabbalistic study. And we're going to meet a man named Jacob Frank next week. And we're going to see how he was involved in the Ukrainian situation. And then after Purim, we're going to look at it from a totally different side. Where we'll reverse it and notice something else that grew in the Hasidic movement in the Ukraine. We'll meet a certain other individual who is known as the man with the good name. And who is that? The Baal Shem Tov. And he is known as the father of Hasidus. And now when you look around and you see all these places that are in the news today, and you realize, oh, there's a Hasidus there, and there's a Hasidus there, and this is going on all over the Ukraine. And we'll talk about the rise of Hasidus and the opposition there within. And finally, at the last week, we'll talk about a different group that rose up that said, we have to do something. And that group developed a very, very strong element to it. They became known as the Chibas Tzion movement, which served as a precursor to an individual named Theodor Herzl. But we're not going to get as far as Herzl. We're going to look at it from the Ukraine perspective, the Odessa connections, and some of the underpinnings of the secular Zionist movement and where it met with some of the religious Zionist movement during this period in time. It all meshed in Ukraine. That's a quick, brief overview of things that are to come. So I thank you all very much. And we will meet in Jacob Frank and the Frankis when we meet again next week. Everyone have a wonderful week, Shabbos, and hopefully Shalom al Yisrael, v'al kol ha'olam kulam.